So welcome everyone to this week's string seminar. We're excited to have Yuri Krutov coming to us virtually from Stanford. And he'll be telling us about JT gravity at finite cutoff. And just to go over the format, just feel free if you have a question to just unmute yourself and interrupt and ask any questions. Okay, so with that, we'll let Yuri take it away.
Thanks, Anthony, and thank you for the opportunity to talk at your seminar, and I hope to visit sometime as well. It would be great too. So this today I want to talk about a work that came out last month with Luca Iliesiu, Joaquin Turiaci, and Herman Felinde. On topic related to what is known as the TT-bar deformation that is widely known in two-dimensional field theory context. And what we will be looking at is a one-dimensional version of that and how that relates to JT gravity at finite cutoff. Yeah, so you can see the archive number on the screen. And it's also based on some earlier work that I did with Edgar Shagulian, Andrew Rolf, and David Gross in these two papers, especially the first one from July. That will be one of the main papers that I will also be following. Let me take you guys back to what this field started, and I was actually in 2004 already. Samolochikov found a particular combination of stress tensors that is now dubbed the TT-bar deformation, TT-bar combination, TT-bar operator, that had some remarkable properties and. Such as factorization, meaning that although this operator was quadratic in stress tensors, in certain states you could still evaluate this composite operator. So this in a later paper by Samolochikov and Smirnov in 2016, this operator was introduced in a sort of a deformation of 2D quantum field theories. And the deformation you can see here is a flow. So this is the S here is the action. You can think of it as Euclidean action or Lorentzian action. I'll be mostly talking about Euclidean actions and path integrals here. So let's take this to be the Euclidean action. And the flow parameter is this deformation parameter lambda, and it instructs you to add at every infinitesimal change in lambda to add this integral of a particular operator, which I will come to what it specifically is later. This operator, the TT-bar operator, is an irrelevant operator and an operator that that has these remarkable properties that Samolochikov found. So at every step along the flow, you add this operator to your action, and this defines a deformation of your theory. And people have also said, oh, this is like a flow in theory space, and so this is like one parameter along which you can flow. So this is the 2D story, and so I alluded to already a little bit before is why is this an interesting deformation? Now, first of all, from a field theoretic point of view, you would say, okay, this TT-bar operator, it's irrelevant. It's a combination of two stress tensors. It will be quite complicated to compute anything. Let me shut off my mail. Hold on. And so this operator is irrelevant, and there are all kinds of problems that, that arise when you want to compute anything in this particular theory. When you add this operator. Now, the remarkable thing is that this operator still has some calculable observables. For example, the spectrum, you can compute the spectrum on the cylinder exactly. There is exactly meaning non-perturbative in lambda, and given the spectrum of the original theory, the seed theory, so the theory with lambda zero, you can also compute. Then you can also compute things like the partition function, and a lot of work has been done on that. There's also some work from Donnelly and Shyam on entanglement entropy computations, and so there's a lot of interesting computations you can do that are tractable and non-perturbative in this deformation parameter. Another interesting reason why to study this type of deformation in a bit more detail is that it isn't an irrelevant deformation. It destroys the UV, or it alters the UV of the theory, and it can give you a sneak preview in non-local theories and relations with and there's strong hints of relations with string theory. And so there's some remarkable lessons that could be learned from this particular deformation. Okay, so those are mostly field theoretic arguments why this deformation is interesting. Another very interesting, and that will be the main focus of the talk today, is the relation to holography. Now, in holography, you can also consider this particular flow, and S would then be the action of some holographic CFT, 2D holographic CFT, that you deform in this way. And it was shown in a work by Magouf, Mitzay, and Verlinde that actually, if you add this particular deformation to your 2D CFT, you will impose Dirichlet boundary conditions. This deformation will be dual to putting Dirichlet boundary conditions on the metric in ADS3. And this deformation parameter then corresponds to some radial cutoff in the bulk. And so that in a cartoon, that picture that what I just said can be viewed in this way. So we have the ADS3 boundary all the way at infinity, at R is infinity. And by turning on this flow, this deformation, what you're doing here is you're putting Dirichlet boundary conditions on this blue circle here. So this at RSRC, the fields that I've collectively notated here with phi, they are held fixed. And so in that sense, you can think of this TT bar deformation pushing the boundary inwards. Right, so that is an important thing that I will be alluding to more in this talk. But for today's purposes, I want to focus on a simpler version. And that simpler version is finite cutoff JT gravity. So there's been a lot of interest recently in JT gravity, and especially the ADS2 version, where a lot of things become even more calculable, and there's relations with an interesting theory called the Schwarzschild theory. And what I want to do today is to present some more evidence in the relation between finite cutoff JT gravity and a 1D version of the TT bar deformation. And in particular, I will show that the recently proposed deformed Schwarzschild theory can be obtained from a radial Wheeler-DeWitt wave functional. Okay, these are all words that I will explain, of course. So let's first get to
Okay, can I ask a question maybe before you go into technical things? So
yes.
I'm confused. I mean, a very naive intuition would have said that if you turn on an irrelevant operator in the boundary theory, in a sense, you're undoing the thing from the original EDS CFT correspondence point of view. You are kind of undoing the near horizon limit. So naively, you could have thought that adding an irrelevant operator would be like changing the asymptotics from ADS back into flat space or along that direction, not towards going to the infrared, if you know what I mean.
I see. So you mean like in the higher dimensional picture, like with the D-brains and you
I'm saying that the decoupling limit killed the irrelevant operators and the asymptotically flat region. But somehow you're saying that this is not what's happening here.
Right. So I think that it's very important that what sign of this coupling you pick. There's indeed one sign that moves you inward and that allows you to talk semi-classically about this Dirichlet boundary conditions and stay within that ADS space. But there's in the other sign, it's not entirely clear yet what that's supposed to happen, but that could correspond to moving outwards, and that would indeed access the flat space region, and then you'll get into these issues about things not decoupled anymore. Yes, I think it's a very delicate question about the sign of this coupling. Yeah, but I think for this sign, there's evidence that it is Dirichlet boundary condition still in that near horizon geometry.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let me flesh out a bit more details about the TT bar deformations in 2D two boundary dimensions, and then we'll later see how the 1D story emerges. So in 2D, I've written the deformation of the action, and this TT bar operator here, I've written it explicitly as a particular contraction of two stress tensors and two epsilon tensors in 2D. And now, from this particular flow equation, you can also write down a flow equation for the Hamiltonian. Say you consider the theory on a cylinder, some radius r, and using the factorization properties that Zamolodchikov found, you can write down an equation, a flow equation for the energy eigenvalues of the theory in the that is non-perturbative in this parameter lambda, and this flow equation takes the following form. So it's a nonlinear differential equation. But remarkably, the solution is quite simple. And so the solution of this differential equation has this square root form. And as you can see, if you take now lambda to zero, then these ones will cancel. And the only thing that is left is this E naught over R. And there might be an R missing here somewhere up front. So E naught here is what I denoted with the original spectrum, and lambda's deformation parameter, R is the radius of the circle, K is your a momentum that could be present because we have a circle, and this particular energy formula, you can match that semi-classically to the energy you would get from computing the Brown-York stress tensor in ADS3 bulk. For a black hole sitting inside an ADS space that is cut off to some radius RC, and that's what I meant with this. That semi-classically, this formula is consistent with Dirichlet boundary conditions on the metric in ADS3. Yeah, so I said already that this was first noted by Magouf et al. Of course, higher dimensional generalizations or other types of deformations are also being considered. So the takeaway is that the with this deformation, the spectrum takes this nice form. just the form spectrum takes this nice form, and you can match that to a bulk computation at with Dirichlet boundary conditions at some finite radius. So now let's see what that would mean in JT gravity. So here I've written the JT gravity action. It contains two parts. Here I've ignored the topological part that is just the Euler character. That will not be important for the story here. So we have the bulk piece, which you can see is just setting r equal to -2 when you integrate out phi over some complex contour. And there is a boundary action, which is the usual Gibbons-Hogg boundary term. And here there's a counter term. And the counter term is completely normal. You have to also have that in higher dimensions where you need to subtract off for the infinite volume, the ADS space. And so with Dirichlet boundary conditions, what I mean here is that the metric on the boundary is fixed to be 1 over epsilon square, and the dilatant phi on the boundary is fixed to be some renormalized dilatant phi r over epsilon. And so if you integrate out the dilatant phi in the bulk, you'll get a boundary action that looks like this, which is dubbed the Schwarzian theory, because you see here the appearance of the Schwarzian derivative. And here T is like a Poincaré time, for example. And there, you could also do it for a disk. And usually this theory arises when you take epsilon to zero, and then you end up with this finite action. And basically the purpose of today's talk is to see what happens when you do not take epsilon to zero, but keep it finite, which would then correspond to JT gravity at finite cutoff. Okay, so let's first see what from the boundary perspective these energy levels, this deformed energy levels need to be. And there's actually a similar deformation that you can write down. Essentially, what you can do is start from the 2D theory and do a dimensional reduction. And of course, there's subtleties related to dimensional reduction, especially if you look at the bulk theory, the 3D Einstein gravity. If you dimensionally reduce that, you'll get JT gravity in the S-wave sector. But it turns out that for us, that'll be enough. The S-wave sector, and so the K0 sector, exactly gives you the energy levels that you can then match to a similar computation of the Brown-Yorke stress center in the bulk of JT gravity. And so this will be the deformed spectrum that that we propose is dual to Dirichlet boundary conditions in the bulk, or at least if I take this new spectrum and I compute the partition function, that I will get the same result as doing the bulk partition function for some finite patch of ADS2. So you might already be a bit worried that these energies, there's a square root, so things can complexify. This is a well-known problem in this whole TT-bar business. And from the bulk, it has an interpretation as the cutoff surface diving into the black hole. Of course, there the GTT flips sign, and so this energy can become complex. But we'll postpone that issue to a little later, and first focus on let's just ignore this issue for now. Okay, so what I just said is that if this is the deformed spectrum, then we should basically take the partition function of the undeformed theory, as for the theory at infinite cutoff, plug in that spectrum, and that is the partition function we should reproduce from the gravity side. And so how does this, what do I mean precisely, is so the boundary theory is, as I said, the Schwarzschild theory, and the Schwarzschild theory has a partition function that you can write down exactly, and in an integral representation, it looks like this. And so it has a particular density of states. It's a continuum. The spectrum is continuous, and so this in strict sense, is not really well defined. But let's not dive into that issue right now. So the density of states is given by the sine hyperbolic square root e, and then here there's the usual Boltzmann factor, which is obtained from a trace over the Hilbert space. Now, here, this energy, if I want to, if I have a proposal for the deformed energy levels that are supposedly give you the finite cutoff JT, then what I should do is plug those deformed energy levels in these Boltzmann factors, and the new Hamiltonian will basically be sitting here. And the deformed Schwarzschild theory, as I will call it, will then take the following form. And I left it here as an integral representations. In the paper, we have some explicit expressions for this object, but that's beyond the scope of the talk today. And it is this particular partition function. And remember, this is a pure quantum mechanics reasoning that I just gave you. I haven't talked about the bulk in any sense. I just took the infinite cutoff answer, which we know is the Schwarzschild theory, and plugged in the new spectrum that I propose is the correct spectrum at finite cutoff. And what I now want to do is reproduce this from a gravity computation. And so now we want to check this beyond the semi-classical limit. And so this spectrum was actually obtained using some semi-classical analysis, Brown-York stress tensor, and comparing that. But now I want to find this partition function beyond that semi-classical limit. Yes.
Do you have any intuition why the cinch measure doesn't get deformed when you deform the theory?
So that will also be is something you can verify a posteriori, in, say, in the higher dimensional case, or the 2D case, is known because the energy levels are just shifted monotonically, and there's no change in the degeneracies. And so of course, here we have a continuous spectrum, so it's a bit tricky, but in the higher dimensional case, it's known that the spectrum will just monotonically change with this deformation parameter, and so not altering any of these degeneracies.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for that question. That's indeed important. In the paper, we actually discussed two ways of doing that, and two of the sort of obvious ways that you could try to do the gravity computation exactly. One is through a Wheeler DeWitt wave functional analysis. So it means that we'll construct the wave functional from the constraints. And another one is a direct evaluation of the Euclidean path integral. And today I decided to, because it would be too much to cover both, I'm just going to focus on the first one. And I think it's a cute analysis with results that were essentially already known in the 80s, and I'm just reusing them to show why this partition function is the correct partition function. Okay, so let's get cracking. So recall that in a Wheeler de Witt analysis, what you do is you foliate your spacetime with particular slices labeled by some coordinate. And in this talk, I will do that in Euclidean space, and the coordinate that will label my slices will be a radial coordinate. And so the metric is parametrized in this way. And so there's the lapse here. There's some metric on the boundary, and there's the shift. And this theta direction is compact, and the topology I will focus on is a disk. So R is radial coordinate, theta is the is a Euclidean time or angular coordinate. And this slices then live at these constant R locations. So this is the parameterization of the metric that I'll be using. And in this parameterization, so the JT action takes the following form. I'll just flash it out again. Here I, for the moment, I'm excluding the counter term. I'll add that in later. But yeah, so the JT action is given by this. And if you write it out in that parameterization, that ADM decomposition, the metric looks like this, where these dots are radial derivatives and primes are theta derivatives. And if you go to a Hamiltonian formulation, as you compute the Hamiltonian, you'll define a few momenta, so pi sigma, pi phi, pi n, and pi n bar, n perp. Then you'll see that these pi sigma and pi phi are related to derivatives of the dilaton. And so this pi sigma is the normal derivative of the dilaton, which is sort of what a different thing that happens in higher dimensions, right? Where you always have that these momenta are related to extrinsic curvature, but here it's related pi sigma, which would really be the usual pi in higher dimensions. This is a normal derivative of phi. And you'll see that the canonical momentum to phi is the extrinsic curvature, actually. So these roles are interchanged. It's the canonical momentum to the metric that becomes a normal derivative of the dilaton, and the canonical momentum of the dilaton that becomes the extrinsic curvature. And of course, as is usual in gravitational theory, is that the canonical momenta of the lapse and the shift are zero, and these lapse and shift act as Lagrange multipliers. Right, so the Hamiltonian of this theory takes the following form, and it's a sum of constraints, and it's a sum of this H, W, H, Wheeler de Witt, and P. And explicitly, these two objects, they are given in the following way. And the Wheeler de Witt, or the constraints that you get are then the Wheeler de Witt Hamiltonian acting on a state needs to be zero, or acting on a wave function needs to be zero, and a P also needs to be zero. And in the quantum case, you upgrade these to quantum mechanical constraints. So that would mean that the canonical momenta are written as functional derivatives, and the constraints act on particular wave functionals, states in the theory, and they have to annihilate that state. And so usually when you do this, this is hopeless. Right? You can't solve it. I mean, these are functional differential equations, pretty complicated to solve them for general profiles of your or general metrics on the slice. But actually for dilaton gravities and JT gravity in particular, you can solve them exactly. And what I mean with solving exactly is that you can even fix the factor ordering ambiguity. So there, usually there's a factor ordering ambiguity, and you don't know how to upgrade this particular term here, because you can insert something in between here and then put the inverse out here, and still have the same classical limit, but the quantum theory will be different. Now, in the way we'll be solving it exactly, there will be a specific factor ordering that is actually really nice, and does not introduce any sort of contact terms that might arise otherwise. And so this was first fleshed out in 85 by Marc Henault, and later also by Martinez and some other people. I can't remember the names, but that was done then for the general dilaton gravities. So that works in the following way. If you look at these equations, so these two constraints, then you can actually eliminate one of the momenta from these two by using these equations. And that can be done because there's a conserved mass, there's the ADM mass in this problem that allows you to you introduce that mass as a sort of a free parameter, and that allows you to eliminate one of the momenta. And once you have eliminated one of the momenta, you end up with two first order functional differential equations. Now, of course, you're still not out of the woods even then, but remarkably, these two first order equations that you get, they look kind of complicated, but they can be solved exactly. And notice that this particular root that appears here also appears down here. And that allows for these constraints to be solvable. And so you can integrate this functionally. So you can find a solution psi as a functional of the value of the dilaton on your slice and the metric on the slice. And this parameter M is here the ADM mass. Strictly speaking, this M is an operator, but this operator can be diagonalized, and you can write your states in terms of these eigenstates of M. This shouldn't be a square, but okay. So these two things can be solved. And now, a little word about the factor ordering. You can see that because this object appears here and here, you can play around by inserting appropriate factors of this object to get the right factor ordering that doesn't introduce any contact terms. Okay, so now the solution to this those two functional derivative equations. There are two branches, as is always the case. You can call them a contracting and a expanding branch. The expanding branch will be the usual one with the ADS boundary, and the contracting branch will be something else. And the general solution is given in this form, where here rho plus minus is a function of this M, and then psi plus minus is given by this exponent. Here I've written it already in diff invariant quantities here down below. But there is a piece that is a square root, which is great for our purposes. And then here, there's another piece that is sort of odd, but in the defaults is tan inverse. You might think that, oh, this is some WKB approximation or something, because there's just a single exponential. It turns out that this is not true. This is just the full solution that can be written in this section as a single exponential. And so to determine the solution, we need to determine this object rho. Now, suggestively, I've already written it as some sort of density of states. We'll see that is indeed true. So how do we fix that rho? Remember that these wave functionals live on particular slices. And one way to figure out what the correct boundary condition is on these wave functionals is take these slices to be very large, then you cover the entire ADS2 space. And then we know what the answer is supposed to be, because it has to be the Schwarzschild theory. Okay, so let's see that in a bit more detail. So I want to take the L. L is, yeah, so let me tell you a little bit more. So L here is the size, this is the length of the boundary. And this phi b here is the value of the dilaton at the cutoff surface, at the slice. And what I want to do is take L large, keep phi b constant, so not depending on u. U is the coordinate along the boundary, and I want to, so these derivative terms are going to drop out. I'm going to take it to be constant, but I'm going to take it large. And so L is going to be large and phi B is going to be large, but constant. Okay. And also let me just focus on the expanding branch, the branch that has a clear geometric interpretation. And so then in that limit, and with those conditions, the wave functional takes this particular form, and in the large L, large phi b limit, the partition from the wave functional goes to this form. Now, let's see what this is. So here, this exponential piece, that is really the volume of the slice. And that can be taken care of with a counter term. And so this basically goes away. And what you're left with is this sum over M, or an integral over M with some unknown function of M here, and then some exponential factor. And what we want to compare this to, once this factor is gone, we want to compare this to the Schwarzschild partition function. And so once I took away that exponential piece up front, what I'm really computing is a partition function, right? Remember that the partition function or the Euclidean path integral is computed with this counter term, and these wave functions are typically, you don't include that counter term. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but I just wanted to get that straight. And so then you see that these two objects, so this integral and this integral here, there you can find what rho plus of n needs to be. In particular, rho plus needs to be this sinh hyperbolic, and L over 2 beta phi b is beta, the temperature, and m is basically the energy of your in the Schwarzschild theory. And so that fixes what this rho of m needs to be. Okay, so we end up with this wave functional, and okay, if we include a counter term, then you'll get this form of the partition function. And now this object is what we've seen before. Before we've seen this exact same form, but then with m being the energy, phi b square is 1 over 8 lambda, and L is this combination of beta and lambda. And when you convert When you plug this in here, you'll find the original deformed fortune theory that I've been talking about before. And so that is a way in which we can now show from a gravitational computation that partition function that I proposed in the beginning of my talk is indeed reproduced by the gravity computation. So let me give a couple of comments. So what is interesting about this this partition function, or actually this analysis that I performed here, so let me go back here, is that it mimics a lot of the analysis that was done in 3D by Friedel. So here you see that you can essentially give a particular spectrum, particular rho of m, and a particular density of states, and it gives you a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with a particular kernel, that is this psi plus. And it's sort of similar in spirit what Friedel did. Recall that there you started with a particular CFT partition function, and then by doing an integral sort of integral transform, although functionally, you could write down a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in 3D gravity. And so essentially, because we could solve now the Wheeler-DeWitt equation exactly from the bulk, this will provide somehow a 2D analog of the Friedel story in 3D gravity, which I think is kind of cute. Okay, so that is one comment. Now, another comment I want to make is that this wave functional, remember that now we've focused primarily on constant dilaton profiles, and so dilaton profiles that didn't depend on where you are on your slice. But if we take the limit where the dilaton and the length of the slice are very large, then our wave functional does also know about the Schwarzschild partition function with a varying dilaton. And so basically the reason for or why it knows about that is precisely because of this sort of odd looking additional piece here, this tan inverse piece that reduces in the large L, large phi b limit precisely to the correct correction you would expect from looking at the Schwarzschild theory with a dilaton that is varying. And usually people have only considered the Schwarzschild theory with a constant dilaton. When you vary, when dilaton is not constant, so it depends on Euclidean time, then you can use some simple relations or composition rules for the Schwarzschild derivative to figure out what the varying dilaton answer needs to be. And you land exactly on the same answer as when you take the L to be large and phi B to be large. So that's another sort of non-trivial check of this wave functional that it passes. Okay. So one of the, and now we come back to sort of a important issue is that the wave function that we found is not real. So that means that our partition function is not real. And this goes back to what I said before, is that these energy levels can complexify. And so if you recall, the energy level formula has a square root in it. And so for too large energy, too large initial energy, the spectrum can complexify. And as for a partition function, that's of course not great. there's various proposals what to do with this. For example, the thing that was discussed a lot is you just flow and then truncate the spectrum. So you throw away all the complex states. So that particular procedure will not give you a solution to the Wheeler de Witt equation. So here I want to take this Wheeler de Witt equation as a guiding principle, and so that particular option is not what I want to consider. Now another thing you can do is try to cure the complexification of the energy levels by including this other branch of the solution. So remember that until now I just looked at the expanding branch. So that means the piece of the wave function that has a clear geometric interpretation. And if I include the contracting branch, this is the different sign of the exponential, then I can actually cure the complex energies. Basically, what I can do is for each branch, I can cut off the spectrum, and then the boundary terms that I would get from the Wheeler de Witt equation, they cancel and I get a solution. But the funny thing is that I need to subtract these two partition functions. And so the partition function for the expanding branch, Z plus, you have to subtract from it the partition function for the contracting branch. And so this is not an ordinary partition function anymore. This, due to this minus sign, the density of states will be negative. But it's still a difference of partition functions. It's not something crazy that, it's negative here and then positive somewhere else again, and then negative again, and there's still these pockets of negative energy. No, there's one positive pocket, one negative pocket. And so the way we like to think about it is it's not computing an ordinary partition function, but something that is, that the minus branch weighted differently. So if I plot that, the density of states looks like this. So there's this odd looking form. And here over here, it goes like square root E. So just the Schwarzschild behavior. Then here it turns around, crosses zero, and then comes back up at 1/2 lambda. And so this is the, when you do that difference, you'll get this combination for the density of states. And yeah, so that is this negative pocket, and at least the complex energies are gone, but you now have a negative density of states. Okay. We're not quite sure what to make of this, but this is one way of getting rid of at least the complex stuff. Another interesting thing here is that the Wheeler de Witt equation seems to allow for a density of states that goes beyond this point here. So at this point, the energy is 1/2 lambda. And beyond that energy, I can basically put any density of states I want. Despite this negative density of state, this is somehow interesting because this says that this whole deformation need not to have any finite spectrum. It can have any spectrum in the UV you want, and it will be interesting to see what particular boundary conditions would fix that that piece. And we're now currently trying to understand what that means, and how you can understand that, and what boundary condition in particular. Maybe some boundary condition at very high energies, meaning a very tiny circle in ADS, for example. I'm trying to see if that could fix this this non-perturbative ambiguity. Okay, so those are some of the problems. one extension that we also discussed is we can repeat our analysis for 2D de Sitter at JT gravity. And there, hence, or then again, you can do this Wheeler-DeWitt analysis, and you have slices that are now labeled by time. And there's a spatial coordinate along the slices. And with this, the exact wave function will just give you a wave function at finite time. And then again, because here all the way at, in Poincaré Carré time, this will go to zero. This boundary can again be thought of in the same way as the ADS2 boundary. And the action there is again a Schwarzschild theory, but then with some factors of I here and there, and that you can match that particular action again to a boundary condition, or you can use that action and that partition function that you can compute in a way by matching onto this wave function and provide a boundary condition. So that is that's also something some interesting observation that you can do with this wave functional. Now, in the paper, we also discuss the computation of the Euclidean path integral directly, so not using the Wheeler-DeWitt analysis. I won't go into that today. That is, and I invite you to read that part of the paper if you're interested, but in particular this partition function is the following. So the action is just the usual JT gravity action, there's a counter term included, and the partition function is a function of the boundary value of the dilaton and the boundary length, and on that so you have your ADS space, you pick some finite patch, you put Dirichlet boundary conditions at the boundary of that patch, and the boundary conditions are just the same as before, but now you don't take this epsilon to zero. Again, of course, the bulk piece of the partition function is still acts as a Lagrange multiplier, setting the curvature to be -2. And the boundary actions reduces to the same thing. It's this, again, this extrinsic curvature. But since you're not in the infinite or in the epsilon to zero limit, there will be corrections in that extrinsic curvature beyond just the Schwarzschild derivative that are important. And in the paper, we explain how you obtain non-perturbative expression a expression for the extrinsic curvature that is valid to all orders in perturbation theory in epsilon. And then we explain how the path integral over the boundary mode can be done and how to obtain the partition function. That again gives you the same partition function that is given by the deformed Schwarzschild theory and by the Wheeler-DeWitt wave functional analysis. This provides another check to all orders in perturbation theory that the spectrum for a TT bar deformed theory is indeed dual to Dirichlet boundary conditions at finite cutoff in ADS2. Okay, that was most of it, what I wanted to tell you. Just a quick conclusion and summary. So we studied the partition function associated to finite cutoff JT gravity as arising from a 1D version of the TT bar deformation. We saw that using the Wheeler-DeWitt wave functional analysis, we found an exact wave functional for JT gravity. And which matches exactly with the result you expect from the quantum mechanics theory. Okay, And a few future directions that we're thinking about now is other topologies. So for instance, here I've drawn another topology that is present in JT gravity with one asymptotic boundary. And of course, the interesting things that can happen here is that this cutoff surface can now enter all the way into the Riemann surface region. And we're trying to understand what that means, how you can compute the partition function exactly. And in particular, also what the finite cutoff version is of the trumpet geometry. And the double trumpet and how that relates to the matrix integral story that's been developed last year. So that is one thing that we're pursuing. Another thing which I think is very important to sort out is this issue about complex energies. I mean, I've given you one example of how you can cure this complex energy, but then preservation of difficulty, I guess, prevailed, and there was again some negative density of states in the spectrum. So yeah, that also is not ideal. So it would be great to see how that can give us a correct result. And then another thing, of course, if we want to do some full holographic computation, there's always matter present and you would want to put Dirichlet boundary conditions on the matter as well, and then this deformation will change, most certainly this exact solvability of the wave function will go away, and so things become much more complicated and intricate. But maybe there's a way to deal with that. And with that, I want to end my talk. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Jurrit. And so we have some time for questions.
Hello, it's Laurent. I have a few questions. Thank you for your talk. It was very nice, and as you mentioned, the link. So I have a question when I did these things in 3D to move into maybe this 2D gravity story could make it a bit clearer. So in 3D, it's true that you can initiate the evolution with any boundary CFT, right?
Right.
And whereas here, you have a very specific density of state that you fix by looking at infinity or by looking at the Schwarzschild computation. Sure. But right. I always thought that, have you thought about fixing that density of state purely from the Willow-DeWitt analysis that is really going up to, the center of the throat, and somehow I always thought that it would be some kind of initial boundary condition there, like a quantum closure of the space that should determine what is the proper density of state instead of a purely asymptotic.
Yes, right. That's a very good point. You mean that when you take the cutoff surface to be very small and see what that
yeah, what's special about that particular choice of density of states versus
right? We haven't in the paper we haven't really discussed this limit, which is more or less the usual. I would guess say the usual Harding-Hawking boundary condition. Mm-hmm. But if we fix the what did happen is that when we fix the density of states to be that Schwarzschild density of state, then when we go at very small circle sizes, the partition function vanishes, which is a little bit odd, because I would maybe expect it to go to a constant I would expect it to go to a constant, but it turned out to go to zero. Now, what you're suggesting is that you start with a boundary condition at the center, which is certainly something interesting to think about. But again, that won't fix the wave function fully, I think. I mean, I guess you need more conditions to fully fix it.
Okay, another question is, here you look only at rigid boundaries, but you could look at boundary gravitons, like start to look at and look at the spectra there. Have you studied that? Like you can wiggle the boundaries a little bit and then see.
Yeah, so these, the analysis I did here and this wave functional is for general metric and and dilaton on the boundary. So that includes the fluctuations that you, which I think it includes the fluctuations that you're talking about. So the metric doesn't need to be constant along the Euclidean circle.
And you see some kind of string spectra appearing from these, you know, higher modes or
no?
We
haven't analyzed actually what happens precisely when you take this dilaton to be varying and what the quantum mechanics is like what is the quantum mechanics that gives you this partition function, this particular thing. That's a very interesting question, and we tried for a little bit, but then this tan inverse is a bit of an annoying beast to work with. It could be that maybe this arises from some Legendre transform, and this arctan arises in a sort of natural way, but no, we haven't. We couldn't really get a nice quantum mechanics action that gives this.
I have another question about the relation. I mean, we expect, as you mentioned, that so far it looks like Willer-De-Witt equation does not necessarily. The validity of quantum gravity or Willer-De-Witt equation does not really necessitate a discrete spectra, right, of area and mass. But on the other hand, you know, we have other evidence that we expect for finite, you know, because of the finiteness of entropy, some kind of mechanism to render that spectra discrete. So, you know, can that be related with the problem of complex energy, or what's your best guess? Have you thought about what quantum gravitational mechanism is behind the discretization of operators?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether a discrete spectrum would solve the issue of these complex energies.
Okay, so maybe they're not related, but what would be, is it some of a topology that or where do you expect this discreteness?
Yeah, it could be that a sum over topologies cures this complexification, that could be. It could also be that I mean, here I've looked at the Willer-De-Witt equation and the constraints arising from that, and there the measure is flat, right? So the measure of these n's and perp is flat. Maybe there's some non-trivial measure there that I have to take into account that will cure this complexification. But then again, the computation done in the Euclidean path integral shows you that you don't really need to. And there's still this complexification. So yeah, there's a bit of a subtle business, these complex energies. I must say, in a recent work by some other people at Stanford, Douglas Stanford and Zhenbin Yang, they also looked at this finite cutoff JT gravity, but from a completely different point of view. They looked at it from these loops. They interpreted them as self-avoiding random walks, and computed the partition function in that way. And then there's a conjectured way how to deal with the measure. And what the probability distribution is for those loops, and they, as far as I know, they couldn't see any complexification happening. But yeah, their result already differs from ours perturbatively. So they're in the these complexifications have a non-perturbatively, but their thing already is different from ours on a perturbative level. So I'm not sure what the correct comparison is there, but I think it's fair to say what happens with these complex energies, I'm not sure. Another thing you can think that is that there's some sort of instanton corrections that needs to be taken into account. Like in the 2D theory, for example, are there instanton corrections that are important that haven't been taken into account in any way? And that could cure the complexification of the energies. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Great questions.
Any other questions? I guess I had one. You said you were looking at the other topologies. Are you like, when you do that, do you also develop this Wheeler DeWitt picture? And do you have a way of understanding the other topologies from the Wheeler DeWitt perspective, or is it purely Euclidean there?
No, this would be purely a path integral type computation. The trumpet geometry, you can still do sort of Wheeler DeWitt analysis, because it still has a cylinder topology, so there's no branching off or things like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you have other branching off of baby universes or things like that, or I don't know, complicated topologies, then I have no idea how to deal with that in Wheeler DeWitt. And I would love to know how to do that. I mean, maybe you have to do some third quantization where you upgrade this whole thing to some sort of action where the field operator creates universes and interactions encode the splitting off of universes or the creation of topology. But yeah, I'm not sure how that works.
Okay, and then one other quick question. I think you mentioned really briefly that the point where the energies go complex is somehow related to the boundary point falling into the black hole. Could you just say what exactly that point was again? Or
yeah, so let's go back to these energy levels. So that this picture will be enough. So imagine that there is a black hole sitting here in the bulk. Mm-hmm. Then when this blue boundary curve goes inside the horizon of that black hole, that is precisely, you can relate that precisely to the location where these energies become complex. And I mean, basically what happens in this formula for the energy levels, you can look at here, this object here is just a GTT component. And if you convert it to gravity variables, This is just GTT.
Okay.
And so that changes sign goes in the direction. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Any final questions for Jurrit?
Well, I do. It raises another question. In fact, here, because you made the assumptions that somehow you were keeping the density of state rho m the same. So you're keeping the weight constant, and then you got the energy becoming complex. But if you do the canonical analysis, it's more natural to, let's say, fix the Casimir of the SL2R and then, allow the weight to become real or complex. That is, there is the black hole corresponds to a continuous series, and then there's particle spectra corresponding to discrete series. Mm-hmm. And when you go inside the horizon, somehow it's kind of natural to change the causal sign of the SL2R Casimir, the boundary charges. So that might be something else. That is, because you see, you fix the density of state only in the limit where you push this energy very, very low, very far away. And
yeah.
So you might have the other option that you should keep the energy positive, but then, render the weights of the state.
I see. Right.
Imaginary, so that so that you're always in a unitary representation of SL2, but you're flipping the series you're working with.
I see. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Because
yeah, I haven't thought about that. Yeah.
With uh-huh. this continuous, I mean, asymptotically, it's clear you're in the continuous series, but when you zoom in, at some point, you know, you might.
I see. Yeah, that's an interesting point indeed. That maybe there's a change of representations going on. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Okay, so I think we've had some good discussion. So we'll cut it off here. So thanks, Jorrit, again. Give you a little clap.
Thanks. Thanks for the pleasure.
Yeah. Feel free to let Jorrit know if you have any other questions.
Yeah, I'll stick around for a bit more if anyone wants to ask some more questions.
Yeah, we have. I guess we have this for a couple more minutes, but then. Yeah. Yeah, it was a nice talk. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.